I'd like to invite you to open your Bibles, if you have one. Turn to that 12th chapter of Hebrews. It's just the verses 1 to 3 for our consideration this morning. We'll just read them again, just to remind us of them. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. I want to thank you all for trusting Josh and I with these four Sundays in April. We know how precious Sundays are to you and how good the preaching is in this place from week to week. So we're grateful for the opportunity to be able to speak. We're asking the question this morning, what did it take for Jesus to run his race well? What did it take for Jesus to run his race well? Multiple writers of the New Testament use this analogy of the race, running the race. And they describe a course that every Christian believer is on, a course which begins when we're saved and ends when we die. And the writer to the Hebrews is no different. He uses this analogy, and we've just read it. Verse 1 says, there's a race course marked out for each one of us. And the point of the book of Hebrews, really, if you boil it down, is that these Hebrew believers, they were growing weary of this race course. It was getting too hard for them, and they were seriously considering throwing in the towel. And so the writer to the Hebrews is urging them, don't do it. Don't throw in the towel. Don't give up so easily. And here in these three verses, he wants to point up the way in which Jesus ran his own race as a means by which these Hebrew believers might be encouraged to continue in their own race. Jesus is set up as the example, and for sure, Jesus had a race marked out for him. God the Father sent him into the world to run a course, to complete a mission. And the course that was set down for him was not a smooth course. It was a rugged one, and it was perhaps more harsh than any one of us dare even imagine. Just think on this for a minute. The Prince of Heaven started out his race in a cattle feeding trough. That's where it began. And during his journey on earth, he had nowhere to lay his head, we're told. He suffered when he was tempted in the desert in diverse ways by the devil. Philip told the Ethiopian eunuch, "Who can speak of his descendants?" Because he was cut off from life in his prime. He was hated by the teachers of the law. He was doubted by his own disciples. He knew both nakedness and cold. He was often hungry and thirsty. He was weighed down with sorrows repeatedly and frequently. When his hour of greatest trial arrived, he was betrayed by a friend, a close friend. And shortly after that, he was deserted by all the others as well. He was falsely accused, and he was subjected to a sham trial. He was spat at, and he was punched, and he was slapped, and he was bound, and he was flogged, and he was stripped, and he was mocked. Crown of thorns was pressed onto his scalp, and he was struck repeatedly with rods whilst he wore that crown of thorns. He was given wine mixed with poison to drink. He bore the humiliation of insults. His name was defamed. His character was assassinated. Nails were driven into his hands and into his feet, and he was hauled vertically onto a wooden cross designed to cause maximum pain and the most prolonged death possible. He had his clothes stolen from him. He was utterly forsaken by everyone, and in a final act of violence against him, a spear was thrust into his flesh. Isaiah says he was assigned a grave with the wicked, though no deceit was found in his mouth, and it was so. You may say other human beings have suffered more. That may be so. But no human being deserved to suffer the way this one did. And no human being ever descended from such great heights as Jesus did. So all of that to say at the outset that the race marked out for Jesus was a very, very dark one. It was grim. And we should not lose sight of it. It was not a 5K park run. It was an extreme endurance marathon that ended in an Everest ascent to the finish line. Jesus' mission from start to finish was a grueling course, and we should not lose sight of it. He must have been tempted to quit almost constantly, and yet he did not. There are two impulses in the text that we've got in front of us. Two huge impulses that I see in verse 2 that might have induced Jesus to pull out in a way that he had explained to Peter in the Garden of Gethsemane when he was about to be arrested, that he could have done if he had wanted. And before we get onto those two impulses, I'll just remind you of what he said to Peter. He said to Peter, "Put your sword away. Don't you know that if I wanted, I could call on my father and he would put 12 legions of angels at my disposal?" Do you know how many angels 12 legions of angels is? 72,000 angels. 12 legions of angels were no more than one word away from Jesus' lips at any moment in time. 72,000 angels would have appeared with swords drawn like that angel that God unleashed, do you remember, on Jerusalem in the time of David, where 70,000 men died in one three-day period. And that was a small number because God mercifully relented and told that angel to stop where he stood. 72,000 angels in a word. There's no doubting that Jesus could have called a halt to all of this anytime he wanted to. He could have said, as a sense of indignation and injustice rose up in his soul, he could have said enough, and sufficient power would have appeared on the scene in the moment to destroy the entire Roman Empire in a heartbeat. Oh, he had power or right to call an end to his ordeal. He just didn't do it. He just did not do it. Two impulses are at work, and the Lord Jesus overcame both of them, and that's what's so crucial. He overcame them, and because he did overcome them, he did not throw in the towel before he reached the finished line. The first impulse is the impulse of pain, and the second impulse is the impulse of shame. I'm getting both of those from verse 2, so you can look at them for yourselves. But we're told that Jesus endured the cross and he scorned the shame. That's what it says in verse 2. He endured the cross and he scorned the shame. Jesus endured the pain. Human beings, they have built in pain avoidance instincts. We all do. Every single one of us. We reflex away from pain, do we not? We recoil even in anticipation of pain. And Jesus was a human being. He had fleshly nerve endings. He had reflexes just like you and I do. He was no different. He felt the blow of a hammer on his thumb when he was joining two pieces of wood together as a carpenter in exactly the same way that you or I would were we using that hammer. Don't start to think in your minds that Jesus didn't feel like we feel. He felt exactly like we feel. No different. Pain seared through his body exactly like it sears through our bodies. Listen to what Hebrews 2 says. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity. For surely it is not angels he helps, but Abraham's descendants. He doesn't help angels, he helps people. For that reason, he had to be made like them, it says. Fully human in every way. So don't diminish Jesus' humanity. It's absolutely imperative that we understand that Jesus went through real agony, real suffering, real torment, just like any one of us would have done had we been on the cross and not him. It's exactly the same. His humanity corresponds to our humanity when it comes to pain. And the writer tells us that he endured that pain. So it shouldn't be difficult for us to empathize. He endured that pain. I looked up on Bible Gateway every other major English translation of the Bible to see what other words were used for this word, endured. And what's interesting is that almost every single one of them goes for exactly the same word. There's practically zero variance between the major translations. Every one of them uses this word, endured. And that's because this word conveys the sense of what it took Jesus to keep him on the cross. It means that when every neurological impulse was to give up, he remained rooted to the spot. That's what endured means. Do you remember when Jesus' family left Jerusalem to go home and they left their 12-year-old son by accident in Jerusalem? And when they came back for him, they found him exactly where they had left him. That's the same Greek word as is used here. It's exactly the same word. Rooted to the spot, remained exactly where he was. In other words, when all that pain seared through his body, he remained exactly where he was. He didn't get down from the cross. That's impulse number one. The pain of the cross, which Jesus overcame by enduring the pain. Impulse number two is shame. What about the shame? The shame of the cross. Well, it would be easy to think, and I'd be tempted to do the same, that shame is easier to overcome than pain is. But I'd urge us all not to think that way. Because the impulse of shame, the impulse to recoil from shame, may be as strong as the human impulse to recoil from pain. Certainly, I've experienced that impulse in my own life. Dignity is part of what it is to be human, isn't it? Dignity is part of what it is to be human. And shame is an undermining of that dignity. It takes the foundation out from that dignity. And so shame ultimately drives at the essence of who we are as human beings. And that's why we recoil from it. That's why we remove ourselves from shame almost always at any cost. Deb told me that she was reading a book recently. And in this book, it said that back in 1996, Copenhagen Zoo decided to exhibit a caged pair of Homo sapiens. And the aim was to force people who came to look at the exhibits in their zoo to think of people as primates, to think of them in terms of their origins as primates. And so they took two people and they put them in a cage. And they said, you've got all these other animal exhibits, and here is another animal exhibit. Well, the only problem was that when the exhibits spent a few hours in the cage, they kind of said, well, don't like it in here. And then they wanted paying. They wanted paying for having to stand in the exhibit. And then they refused to heed the call of nature. And last of all, they said, we really don't want to be subjected to any intimate behavior in the full view and gaze of the public eye. Thank you very much. We are human beings, don't you know, after all. Guess how long the exhibit lasted? 2 weeks. Not very long. Why? Why? Why was that the case? Because human beings are not primates. Human beings are made in the image of God, and because they're made in the image of God, they have dignity. And it was shameful for two of them to stand there on public view and to do certain things that animals have no shame about doing whatsoever. The impulse to avoid shame is a human impulse. And because it's a human impulse, and because Jesus was human, he experienced the same impulse. So shame was an obstacle to Jesus enduring on the cross, just like pain was. And we should not underestimate it. Not only that, but shame is intensified, is it not, where the difference between the depths of degradation and the heights of exaltation are furthest apart from one another. So, take a child who has grown up on the streets. It does not experience shame to the degree that a king would if you took him out of his courtly palaces and put him on the streets and said, you live on the streets now. The shame that that king would experience would be much greater, because the fall would be that much greater. So Jesus's degradation, the nakedness, the mocking, the character shaming, spit running down his face, the shaking limbs, the weeping flesh, the insults, the abandonment, were all maximally magnified because of his heavenly origin. Yes, Jesus was a man, but he was not merely a man. He was God manifest in the flesh. Yes, he was forsaken by his earthly friends, but his cry at the end was not, where are my earthly friends? It was, my God, why have you forsaken me? That was his cry. The point is that he had come from highest heights, from the very courts of heaven, where thousands upon 10,000s of angels had worshipped at his feet. His humiliation was greater by far than any humiliation ever known by any human being, supremely because no one can attain to the glories from which he came. The text says that instead of responding to that impulse of shame, he scorned it. He scorned the shame. He did this. I spit in the face of shame. I spit in the face of shame. I despise it. He bore the ignominy of that abuse and that abandonment. That's impulse number two. That's the shame of the cross. And Jesus overcame it by despising it. He endured the pain and scorned the shame in order to reach the finish line. If he hadn't have done those two things, he would not have reached the finish line. He would have thrown the towel in. That's the point. Remember, only Jesus' death could accomplish forgiveness of sins. It's not the experience of pain which accomplishes forgiveness of sins. It's not the experience of shame which accomplishes forgiveness of sins. It's death. It's that he died that accomplishes forgiveness of sins. He had to die. Pain and shame, they were the obstacles to completing the course. They were the obstacles to the finish line. And it was because of you and me that he endured the pain and he scorned the shame. That is, if you believe it was because of you. If you believe it was because of you. God the Father sent Jesus to death on the cross as a substitute. He bore in his flesh the just and righteous wrath of God as a substitute for you and for me, if we believe it. You must believe that it was for you that he went to the cross. You must believe that it was for you that he scorned the shame. You must believe that it was for you that he endured the pain. You must believe that it was for you that he endured to the very end and did not throw the towel in. Because when he got to the end, he did die. And when he died, he took away the sins of people. People like you and me. Jesus slogged it out to death for me. Yes, he did. If you believe he went there as your personal, all-sufficient substitute, then he bore the pain and the shame to death for you. That's the message of the gospel. Hebrews 12:1-3 is encouraging us to run like Jesus ran. You have a race to run if you're a Christian. Now run it like Jesus ran it. But what I want to know, for me, is how did he do it? I appreciate he scorned the shame. I appreciate that he endured the pain. But how? But how? How did he do it? When all those impulses were telling him, get down off the cross. Quit whilst you're ahead. You don't deserve this. How? How did he do it? I want to know how he did it. If I'm meant to run my race like he ran his, how did he do it? How did he reach the finish line? How did he overcome the obstacles? How did he resist the impulses? And that's what the rest of the message is about. How did he do it? Perhaps it's not surprising that since Jesus was a man, since he was human, and he suffered when he was tempted to quit, that the means by which he endured are means that we as humans are familiar with. So because he's a human, because he endures in a human way, because he suffers in a human way, the means by which he is able to do those things are also human. They're also things that we can emulate. They're also things that we can apply. And verse 2 tells us that very clearly, it was for the joy that was set before him. It was for the joy that was set before him that he endured the pain and scorned the shame. That's the means. That's the how of it. How did he do it? For the joy that was set before him. And we need to unpack that a little bit so that we get a good idea of what that means. The other, the motivating factor was a joyous benefit. That's what it means. The motivating factor was a joyous benefit, which, when weighed against all the pain and all the shame, outweighed it all. So Jesus looked ahead and he saw something so good, so desirable, so surpassingly worthwhile, that it outweighed everything that he was about to go through. That's how he did it. It was for the joy that was set before him. When I was a child, we used to go on holiday to Switzerland quite often in the summer. And my parents decided, in all of their wisdom, that they would take us on an all-day hike in the High Alps, which they sold to us as being an exciting thing. That's fine. That's no problem. So we set off early in the morning. We packed a few snacks and some water in a bag. And we set off on this high alpine trail. And in Switzerland, as many of you know, in the summer, the temperatures, they can elevate. Mid-30s, late-30s. It can get pretty hot. And we were on this trail high up in the mountains, and it was getting hot. And after a few hours, the path, which has started out fairly level, just started to do that. And the incline got steep, and the trail got a bit more torturous, and the sun started to beat down, properly beat down. And all of a sudden, all that enthusiasm which we'd had at the beginning was like down here somewhere, you know. Like the pace has slowed to a trudge and we're moaning, you know, Dad, when's this going to end and how much further is there to go and why do we come on this trail and all this kind of stuff. And I remember really vividly, I remember my dad saying to us, "I didn't tell you this, but there is a hut. There is a shack on this trail. No towns, no amenities whatsoever, but there is this one shack. And it's at the highest point. It's the top of the mountain, basically. And I have it on good authority that they sell chilled Coke in a bottle there." Okay, so I'm just telling you right now that when we get there, I'll buy you a chilled Coke in a bottle. Now, they probably airlift this stuff in. It's so high up, right? So you can imagine it's like 10 quid a bottle of Coke or something like that. So he must have really wanted us to do that walk. He must have really wanted us to do it because he was incentivizing us with a chilled bottle of Coke. And I tell you what, it did the trick. It did the trick. I have never been so compelled to pick up my feet and walk. I could taste the sweetness of that Coke from 3 miles away. It did the trick. Of course it did. What it did is the tantalizing thought of getting my hands on a chilled Coca-Cola when it was beating down 35 degrees and we had a long way to go was so sweet and it was so real. That, and I believed him completely, by the way. I believed him 100% that it took us on our way. It motivated us to keep going, to pick up our feet and to move forward on the trail. And we did. And we did. And I'm glad to say that he wasn't lying to me. There was Coke there. And he did buy me a Coke. And I'm grateful for that Coca-Cola all these years on. The prospect of the reward was so tantalizing that covering 1,000 vertical feet in just over 1 horizontal mile was like nothing to me. That was easy. Every single laden step of the way was well worth it for that Coca-Cola. And every drop of sweat as well. In other words, when the reward outweighs the pain, the result is we make it to the finish line. It works in our thinking. We know it. We know all about it. This is how elite athletes do it. My colleague, he worked for a Premier League footballer, no names mentioned, and he commented that one night after a long design meeting, it was suggested that everyone would have fish and chips supper. And so they went out and they bought all the fish and chips, sat down to eat, and he noted that the elite footballer was not eating fish and chips. He was eating dry pasta and drinking water. And he was like, how do you do that? How do you do that? When if it, just the smell of it, you know what the smell of fish and chips supper is like. So good, isn't it? How do you do that? And the answer is, he sets his thoughts on lifting the trophy at the end of the season. That's what he does. He sets his thought on the glory of lifting the trophy at the end of the season. And when he looks at that fish and chip supper, he sees it as a lead weight. That's how he sees it. Lead weight. It would be an obstacle to achieving the goal. And therefore, it's out. It's out. It's not even on my radar. Doesn't even consider it. He doesn't smell what you and I smell when we smell fish and chip supper. Just in the way. And so he doesn't partake. He doesn't partake because it wouldn't aid him in his running. So Jesus kept before his mind's eye, with unwavering constancy, the prize at the end of the race. And that was so motivational that it enabled him to endure the pain and despise the shame. That's what the writer of Hebrews is telling us. What was the nature of that joy that was set before him? What was the nature of it? Well, the reward he was looking to, it wasn't a pillow to lay his head on, even though he didn't have one of those on earth. It wasn't a full stomach or a full set of clothes, even though he was deprived of those things as well. No, it wasn't any of those things. It was the prospect of the glory of the Father in heaven that sustained him in his race to the finish line. That's what it was. Just two verses from John 17. Verse 5. Now, Father, glorify me in your presence with the glory I had with you before the world began. Verse 24. Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am, to see my glory, the glory you have given me. So Jesus set before himself the joy of restored fellowship with his Father in his presence, the glory of his Father's delight in him, the pleasures of being exalted to the right hand of the Father as Prince of Peace forever, worlds without end. The promise of the reward was fixed and it was unchangeable. The taste of the reward was eternal and it was sweet beyond compare. That's how he did it. The certainty of things hoped for, not yet attained. Reaching forward, taking a hold of the prize, making it his own, making it a reality so tangible that nothing could overcome the power of it. Nothing could overcome the power that motivated him to keep going. Not even the power of pain and shame could overcome the power of the promise of that thing, of sharing fellowship with the Father in heaven. The glory of it. That's what he said, set before his eyes. So all boiled down then, when you think about it like that, our salvation in reality was because Jesus fixed his eyes on a better and lasting possession. He counted it more valuable than escaping the pain and shame of the cross. That's the thing. He counted it more valuable than escaping the pain and shame of the cross. And so, because he did not throw away his confidence, he was richly rewarded when he reached the finish line. Easter is most assuredly, about remembering and celebrating and proclaiming the cross work of Jesus for the forgiveness of sins. No doubt about it. I endorse that 100%. But Hebrews 2 helps us to see the means by which Jesus actually finished his race, bringing us full and free salvation. The writer to the Hebrews is at pains to tell us in verse 3 that if we look to Jesus, considering him who endured, who did not give up, who endured such opposition from sinners, that person will not grow weary and will not lose heart in their own race. That's the promise. We must persevere in our race. We must keep going in our race. There are no guarantees that the Christian race is going to be easy. None. In fact, I can guarantee you it's going to be hard, because the Bible says that through many trials we must enter the kingdom of heaven. You don't enter the kingdom of heaven without trials, and many of them. You just don't do it. It's not God's design. It's not his way. He's designed the course for you, for every one of you who knows him. He's designed your course. It's a good course. Even though it's tough, even though it's grueling in places, it's a good course, because he made it, because he designed it. Nothing that he has designed can be bad. It's a good course. But there are going to be the twin impulses of pain and shame to overcome if you're going to run your course. If you're going to get to the end, there are going to be these impulses that must be overcome for every single one of us. And the writer to the Hebrews is saying, you've got a forerunner. You've got someone who went ahead of you, who did it perfectly, who did it the way it needs to be done. He's shown you how to do it. He's shown you how to overcome the obstacles. He's shown you how to reach the finish line. He's shown you how to endure. He's shown you how to scorn and despise shame. Now follow in his footsteps. That's what he's saying. The death of Jesus absolves us of our sin. Thanks be to God that it does. And it shows us the way forward. It shows us how to continue to the very end, to run the race that God has marked out for us, to approach it the way that Jesus approached it, to not grow weary in pursuit of it, to not lose heart, even though many obstacles beset us. And when those twin impulses of pain and shame encourage us to quit, set before yourself a better and lasting reward. The reward of God himself. The reward of joy in his presence forevermore. Set it before you in your greatest difficulties. Set it before you in your greatest challenges. And run a race like Jesus ran. Easter is for spurring us on our journey to the promised land by looking unto Jesus, who is the author and perfecter of our faith, and for the joy set before him, endured the cross and scorned its shame. May God bless us this Easter time, and may these words be used in our lives. Amen.
Amen.